You're listening to The Fifth Estate, recorded live at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. For our final episode of 2018, Sally Warhaft hosts a political rap of the year with guests George Megalogenis and Gabrielle Chan.
And terrific timing tonight, accidental again, to have our political rap. Although, there's a long way to go till Christmas, right? I thought, could we ask the Wheeler Centre to let us do the rap on New Year's Eve, but they're shut. It is a real pleasure to have our two guests tonight to wrap up the year. I think we could not have a better combination. Gabrielle Chan is a former and current political correspondent for The Guardian. She's also worked for The Australian, for the ABC and The Daily Telegraph. And Gabrielle moved from the Canberra Press Gallery to marry a sheep and wheat farmer in 1996, and she has raised her family and lives in the small town of Harden, thank you, in New South Wales. And she's done an absolutely fascinating and wonderful thing and written a book about the politics in that town. And it's called Rusted Off. And it's a book that casts really intelligent and experienced eyes on the way people outside of the cities see and think about politics. It's one of those books when you read it, you think, why wasn't in my bookshelf 10 years ago? So it's terrific. George Megalogenis, of course, is a... he's been here before and he'll be back again, I hope. He is a Walkley Award-winning author, essayist and journalist. His books include The Australian Moment, Fault Lines and The Longest Decade, but his masterpiece is The Football Solution.
Hands up, Tiger fans. How many?
How many Tiger fans? How Richmond's premiership can save Australia. And there's a new edition due on Monday the 30th of September next year.
How Richmond's premierships can save Australia.
When Richmond...
There's a typo on the cover.
..actually beat Collingwood by a point on the siren because there can't be enough misery for them. And we...
Welcome
have
to Melbourne, Gabby.
Yeah. I'm starting to get a few.
Big warm welcome.
Thank you.
The political sort of drama began this year with the resignation of Barnaby Joyce. You know, we've lost a deputy prime minister, a prime minister, a foreign minister, and collective minds. And it leads up until today, of course, with the defection of Julia Banks, the member for Chisholm, to the cross benches. I guess just a quick reflection on that. I don't want to get bogged down in today's news because we want to talk about the year. But, George, what were your first impressions today upon hearing this?
Her timing was exquisite. So the Prime Minister...
Not as good as ours, but yes.
So the Prime Minister and the Treasurer were announcing the bring forward. That's a very, very clunky word, but that's what they were doing. They were literally bringing the budget forward by a month. The budget was going to be, is now going to be released on the 2nd of April. And as they're calling this press conference, which tells you that they're pitching an election at the latest possible date in May, and presumably they'll release the budget and then go straight into a campaign, Julie Banks is getting up on the floor of the Parliament basically at the same time. I assume you had to run a split screen if you could do that for your coverage, while the two blokes are trumpeting the looming surplus, and she's taken their minority status into the abyss because now there are only 74 votes they can rely on in the lower house. So they don't, in a parliament of 150, that makes it very difficult. But I thought, I don't think she meant it to come out that way. I don't think her intention was to gazump a prime minister and a treasurer making a fairly significant announcement on the timing of the budget. I think the Victorian election pushed her over the line. But Scott Morrison, if you think through what could have stopped this from happening, and he must have known one, maybe more, would move to the crossbench, because the incentives, especially after the Wentworth by-election, and we saw this with the Gillard government as well when she was in minority, the incentives at the margin for, you know, on the Labor side, a grandstand, and there were a couple of them on the Labor side that were always threatening to walk to the crossbench, you know, to sort of maximise their leverage. The incentive in the coalition, with all the divides between the men and the women and the moderates and the dries and the city and the country folk in the party room and the religious and the not so religious in the party room, there's always one that was going to slip, and she was the one they worried about the most. And I wonder whether Scott Morrison was resigned to this happening, because he could have done a lot more to stop her from leaving, because she flagged, Gabby, this is right, it's about... almost immediately after the challenge, she flagged that she had a concern with the way that challenge was conducted. She felt not just her, but a number of other women were being heavied by the Dutton camp. Never identified anyone in the camp, but she assumed it was the Dutton camp she was talking about. He promised to look at it. 3 months later, nothing's happened. And of course, this is where it ended up.
Gabrielle, how did you read it today?
Well, for me, it just underlined the hollowing out of the Liberal Party. I don't think it's any coincidence that she's a woman, she's a moderate. She very much lines up with the Karen Phelps of the world, with the Cathy McGowans, the Rebecca Sharkies. And, you know, they're starting to look like quite a force on the
They're starting to look like a Liberal Party.
They are.
Made up of women.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's just more of the same.
At the same time today as those two things were happening, Dan Andrews also got in on the act to announce that for the first time, I think possibly in Australia, certainly in Victorian government, 50% of the cabinet are women. So there's a real crowding for the news headlines this evening. Let's move to the probably the most significant event this year, I suppose, which was the leadership spill and a new Prime Minister. On the 20th of August, George, you tweeted, if the Liberals do decide to blow their brains out and roll another leader, that would give Australia six Prime Ministers for the decade so far, just one short of the all-time record of seven in the first decade of Federation. And I responded to that tweet saying, they will. The next day, they tried, but actually were so incompetent they couldn't even roll a Prime Minister when they thought they had the numbers. But a couple of days later, of course, Scott Morrison found himself the big cheese. Why did they do this?
Who wants to go first? Gabby, do you want to go first?
Yeah, Gabby, you go first with this one.
Why did they do it?
I think they did it because they're totally disengaged with the electorate. You know, I live in one of the safest National Party seats. I live in Michael McCormack, the leader of the National Party seat. And the anger there was palpable. And yet, at the same time, a number of Liberals in that Dutton camp were telling me, you know, you don't understand, the electorate, you know, wants to move this way. And I just couldn't see it. And I was tweeting about the anger that I saw around me in my very conservative electorate. And, you know, people were saying typical, you know, Guardian lefty latte sipper, you know, of course that would happen, you know, in the inner city where you are. I said, mate, you've got no idea. You know, that it really was palpable. And I think the party has disengaged from listening to anyone but, you know, the extremes now. And that's why they keep making the mistake.
Just before I get George's response, what was your sense on your high street of Barnaby going?
Barnaby was a really... it was a bit of a roller coaster ride as far as Barnaby's concerned. So I talk about in the book his capacity to cut through. So while we in the press gallery and city electorates might not see, you know, his attraction, originally the attraction was that he didn't talk like a politician. So he had that language that cut through, and the polls suggested that, you know, everyone thought he was the leader of the National Party well before he was, you know, because Warren trusts Warren who, you know. Barnaby came along and changed that. Once the affair broke and, you know, there was still some support for him in terms of, oh, his private life is his private life. Now, I don't think that would have happened for Julia Gillard in my electorate, you know, if the same had have happened with her. The breaking point was when he sort of attempted to disavow the child. That's really changed things, and that was just like no-go zone, you know, and people just fell away in support for him.
Back to Morrison, Georgia. I mean, when Kevin Rudd got rolled by Julia Gillard, I think I spent like a week in bed. You know, when Julia Gillard got rolled by Kevin Rudd, I think I, you know, I spent the day in bed. Now, of course, I just, you know, turned on the news, got the headlines and turned it. There's something that's significant, isn't there, about the normalisation of this?
Yes and no. Certainly people aren't surprised when this thing happens again and again and again. Just this morning, I'm not going to take it off track, but just this morning I gave an address to the Year 9 at my old high school, Melbourne High, and on democracy, of all things. And I had to count back...
A history lesson.
I had to count back and remember that their first year in the primary school system was 2010. So they've grown up in this particular environment. So they've known nothing but the volatility. And one of the questions from the floor was about, clearly there must have been a period of stability in the past. And he asked me, what did it look like? And how soon do you reckon we can get this? Very, very clever question. Now, the... this particular leadership challenge, though, I think the coalition underestimated how it's more than just the damage that the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd thing did to the Labor Party, because the Labor Party enter office at the end of 2007 riding an extraordinary wave of expectation and have a pretty good first couple of years. And one of the stats that out of the Australian election study that you need to remind yourself that this is what it felt like in 2007. Satisfaction in democracy was at the highest level of all time in the Australian election study. It was close to 90%. 90% of the population, when they changed the government on their terms, a long-term government that they were kind of okay with but were a bit fatigued by at the end, close to 90% of the population was satisfied with the democracy. That means Liberal voters as well. So there was something, there was a sense of renewal at the end of 2007. By the time you lose Rudd in 2010, you get that big free fall in trust in democracy and, satisfaction in democracy. And the other stat, which is the really important one, and this is at an all-time low, do you trust your government? So trust in government is at an all-time record low. And that's been the story since 2010. Now, the coalition, having watched this and laughed their heads off for the 6 years, that a government that comes in with so much going for it, so much popular goodwill, plus they avoid a global recession, so they haven't done too badly in the first couple of years, to be gifted power so quickly and to be gifted power to a leader in Tony Abbott that's clearly not the most popular Prime Minister we'll ever have in our lifetimes, to have observed what Labor did and then not just do it once, but twice, and the second time to do it for no reason, and to have the cameras on you for the entire week. And I think, Gabby, you're right. They misunderstood how crazy they looked. They were talking to each other. They had a few people in the in their echo chamber, 2GB, Sky After Dark, and a couple of columnists at a couple of papers. I don't remember which ones, you know, and I don't remember which columnists. But that's the world that they've been living in for so long that they no longer understand how it looks on the outside. So, you know, when couples are way past the point of reconciliation and they walk in for the Christmas lunch and they're arguing on the way in, and then they sit down and expect to have a normal Christmas lunch with the other 20 or 30 people there. This is what they look like now. And I think a switch went off in the community that week. So I've been out of the daily journalism game for a while, so you do start to get a different sense in the community when politics comes on people's radar. You don't talk about it at the school gate, you don't talk about the cafe much, you certainly don't talk about it at the footy. But that week, a couple of old blokes came up to me at the local coffee shop that I go to. One guy grabbed me and he said, "What are you going to do about it?" Me? What am I going to do about it? He was really angry. And this is a Liberal seat I live in. Not dissimilar to your experience in the bush. Yeah, and I live in a very safe Liberal seat. May not be safe after Saturday, but...
Well, I mean, I want to ask that. Is there any such thing now as a safe seat after Wentworth, after what happened in Victoria on Saturday? I mean, I would have thought if I was Bill Shorten on Sunday morning, the first thing I'd be doing is finding out who precisely the ALP candidates are going to be in every safe seat, in the country.
I'd be thinking, certainly there's that guy in Brighton, who's not a guy yet, is he? He's only 19, right? And where did he get the money for that campaign?
It was only $1,900.
Yeah, $1,900. So, you know, he put his campaign on his credit card. Yeah. He wouldn't have even blown his monthly limit, right?
Nearly stuffed up his gap year. Yeah.
Almost won Brighton. In fact, on the night he was ahead, and even after the pre-polls, you know, he still banked a 8-10% swing in Brighton, right? Caulfield almost fell. Hawthorne...
Box Hill did.
Box Hill, the big one is Ringwood, because there's no way Labor would have been looking out there. Like, if any Labor people in the room beg to differ, I'd be very interested to know how something like a Ringwood could ever come on your radar. This is, for people outside of Melbourne, very eastern suburbs, very churchy, lifetime, very strong Liberal vote. So if those seats are moving 5, 10 and more percentage points on the primary vote, it's on. But it's never been on before for the Menzies Liberal Party at a federal level to this extent. So when they lose elections, and you can count them on the one hand because they've been in power more often than not since 1949, they only lose by a little. And Labor always goes in thinking they're going to be one-termer or two-termers. They're always thinking about Scullin on the Labor side. So the Coalition have never been booted out of office as a government in a landslide before. Labor have obviously had some epic losses. Gough in 75, Keating in 96, Rudd in 2013. And at each step, when you look at what happens to the primary vote, it goes from 40-odd to 38-odd to 33. So ding, ding, ding. The exit vote for Labor gets lower and lower each time. If they go anywhere near a landslide, I can't see that party holding together even for a single term in opposition. That would be my brave call.
So, Gabrielle, as you sit here in the Wheeler Centre, which is just, you know, the centre point of, you know, something that isn't the rest of Australia.
That's very polite.
And you hear us talking about the Victorian result, as Daniel Andrews, you know, said, the most progressive state in the country. Does any of this sort of feel like it could be ringing true? You know, you described the safest seat where you live, but in out of city areas in the rest of the country, can you imagine that there could be surprises that far?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look at Mildura. They're still counting in Mildura. That is a really interesting seat, that one. That was, you know, on over 8% margin. Ali Cupper, who's the deputy mayor there, and ran as a Labor candidate last time, this time ran as an independent, always proudly progressive, very outspoken on marriage equality. So she had, you know, people knew who she was, and yet she looks like she's going to get in a very, very conservative seat. One of the most conservative, again, at a federal level, held by Andrew Broad. It feels, even around me, like it could happen anywhere, and I know that there's been an uptick in parties, in talk about independence. You know, suddenly people are feeling like even rural and regional seats are winnable. There were, again, a lot of rural women running across, particularly across the north of Victoria and margins. I know Peter Walsh was saying that, you know, the Nats did really well. They held their seats apart from, you know, depending on what happens in Mildura. But their margins were cut substantially, and which makes the next election another very interesting election. And I don't know that people will come back. I think, you know, as parties, you know, essentially break their contract with voters over what they're going to do, voters are breaking their contract with parties and saying, well, you know, if you're not going to do the right thing by me, I'm not going to do the right thing by you.
There have been three elections, two by-elections, one state, one federal and a state election since the leadership change. Tell them about Wagga, if they've forgotten about Wagga.
So Wagga is, as a state electorate, is very near me. There was Liberal Party MP resigned in disgrace, and a former independent, an independent candidate who had run before in 2010, a doctor, Joe McGurr, basically ran in that campaign. The National Party didn't run because of the coalition agreement. And, you know, it was a huge misreading by both the Liberal Party and the National Party not to have a three-cornered contest there. And, you know, this is part of the anger that, you know, this deal is done, and without the kind of, I guess, the support or say-so of the electorate. And, you know, they just presented one Liberal candidate and she got smashed. Absolutely, at 30% margin, you know.
The misreadings.
And this one, yeah, just quickly, this one gets forgotten in the, because Wentworth came next, and now we're talking about what happened on Saturday, but the New South Wales government was in relatively good shape, you'd think, and we know that the Labor leader is now gone because he turned out to be an absolute creep. I'm allowed to say that, I think. I'm quite confident. I'm quite confident of facts here. But a swing of that order, it did stun people around the place.
Absolutely. And they're all suddenly looking at other independents, because I did two book events in Wagga last week. And suddenly this whole new conversation starting, you know, about competition, market competition, because in country seats we haven't had that.
Yep.
And so people make these assumptions about what is a country seat. And I think, you know, the political environment and independents particularly are in the process of rewriting what our idea of a country seat should be.
The misreadings this year, I mean, it's just been idiotic. I mean, just Peter Dutton, for starters, thinking that he was going to be the next Prime Minister and his misreading of how that might play. Turnbull's parting gift, of course, was Scott Morrison. What do you think of him as our dear leader, Gabrielle?
I just wish he'd close his mouth for, like, I don't know, half an hour. And actually, instead of keep saying, I'm listening, I'm doing, I'm seeing, I'm... What that crazy formulation that he has, to actually listen and think for a minute about what it is people are so angry about. I think that's the problem. He's going like a million miles an hour, like a bull at a gate, without thinking about, you know, what are people telling me here? And every time he comes out of a contest like a Wentworth, nothing to see here, moving on, you know. And he's just not learning the lessons. I don't know how much more clearer the electorate has to be to you know, tell them their displeasure.
Do you like him, George?
Do I like him? I don't mind him as a human being. I just wonder whether somebody that entered the parliament in 2007, that's his entry year, someone who enters the parliament in 2007 as prime minister within 11 years, and Kevin and Julia both fit that sort of apprenticeship time frame, whether they're ready for the top job. And I guess one of the questions I've got in my head, and I can't resolve it yet because I can't get inside his, and I'm not sure he would be honest enough with himself to have this internal conversation. Is he ready for it? I doubt that he is, but is he aware that he's not ready for it? And if you're aware that you're not ready for it and you've really basically taken the job by accident, or you're taking it basically to stop the party from completely disintegrating before your very eyes and the government, how do you conduct yourself knowing the very unusual circumstances that got you in a position like this? I would have expected him to be a little more humble, but at the moment he's obviously calculated that he's just going to brazen it out. Basically turn up every day, I'm here, you're not, and you know that Bill Shorten is someone you don't like anyway, and sooner or later I'm going to land a punch on him. I'm going to land a blow on him that sticks. And then, but I don't think he's even thought that far ahead. So they change leader and you're still behind in the polls. So I think that's one of the questions for him. One of my concerns, and this has sort of been apparent when I was sort of having a look at what happened on each of the changes. So Gillard from Rudd, she ditches the climate change totally, starts to think about transporting refugees to, it was East Timor, the East Timor solution, although that sounded
Malaysia.
Like... No, her...
Oh, okay.
She was thinking, was thinking straight after she got the prime ministership. Malaysia came later. Mm. And she wanted a plebiscite, a sort of people's convention on climate change, and she let the mining companies write the mining tax legislation for it. Anyone, you remember those two or three things that were happening? And then in the campaign, the single biggest spending item in the campaign was for chaplains in schools. So, and she showed this. So the circumstance, we probably could turn that phone off. Sorry about that. That's okay. So in the circumstance of becoming a prime minister in rather dramatic, in a sort of rather dramatic scenario, she does all these big course corrections, which clearly haven't gone to cabinet, clearly haven't been tested with advisers, and it's disrupted our body politic. Rudd takes over in 2013. What happens?
Same thing.
Well, the most terrible part of it is the thing we're still living with, is that now no asylum seeker who is even found to be a genuine refugee who arrives after the election campaign of 2013 could ever land here. And that's not a policy he personally believes in. He just had to do it as a shortcut. Dutton, in that first couple of weeks, especially trying to save Wentworth, blows up a free trade agreement with the Indonesians.
Morrison.
Mm. Not Dutton, sorry. Mm. Sorry, my bad. Morrison blows up a free trade agreement. So this, apart from how terrible it looks out there to have a prime minister every other year, the thing that the new prime minister does without any mandate, without any authority from the electorate, is quite disruptive to Australia's national interest. And I think that that's where my greatest concern at the moment is. Morrison is so far behind that he's going to be doing more of this stuff between now and the next election. So I dread to think where it lands. Mm.
I can't think of a year where it's just so hard to recall what the government's done. And it's not because they haven't done anything. It's because it's been so clouded with so much, you know, fog and nonsense. But what have they done that has impressed each of you?
Oh, George will have to take this question first.
So notwithstanding the announced cut in the migration program, a cut that is not a real cut because we run a demand-driven migration program and we haven't been able to fill the cap in the last year, so he says the cap is going to be 30,000 lower. I think the single best thing that they've achieved is that they've been able to hold the line on an open migration program. Seems a bit counterintuitive for someone like me to say that, but for all the crazy rhetoric in that space about population pressures and the like, Scott Morrison, both as Treasurer and now as Prime Minister, and certainly Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister, whilst they dog whistle around a number of things, and if you ask me for both sides of the balance sheet, it's cancelled by some of the scare campaigns they're doing, especially around, you know, the inability for all Melburnians to go to a restaurant at night. I think the fact that they've actually held the line and they understand what the national and the economic interest is, I think that is other things. Considering the pressure that they've put them to, the self-inflicted harm that they've done to the government, the fact that they've been able to hold that line is I'd give them a tick for that.
Gee, it's not an election-winning strategy, though, is it? Particularly if you think of Daniel Andrews. I mean, the most common thing I hear about him, I'm sure it's true for, you know, everyone else, they do things. This is a government that gets things done.
Verbs.
Even things you don't like, if there's enough happening, people will accept things they don't like because there's enough, and just a sense that government is governing. And saying that the greatest achievement is stopping something from happening, that was Kevin Rudd's biggest problem, wasn't it? That he stopped a potential recession or so on and
couldn't claim credit for it.
Could never claim credit for it. Yeah. Nothing that's...
Well, I mean, I can only think of things that they have been pushed to, like the Bankroll Commission. You know, that was coming for so long, and I guess eventually they relented. And I think that will change, you know, things substantially, I think, for a lot of people. But so much of it has been a kind of roiling, you know, mess. And, you know, I've lost calendar years now, but the example was, you know, when Labor came out and said they were going to do something on negative gearing, and the government had been thinking about doing something, but it was Morrison himself, I think, who led the charge and said no, because we've got to have a way of differentiating the policy. That sort of game playing, I think, is really what's turning people off. And yet, you know, you have a Bankroll Commission, you drag kicking and screaming to it, and, you know, people see real results for it. So
with marriage equality as well, last year, they can't claim it as a win if they had to contract it out, outsource it to the public to solve that issue, or the Banking Royal Commission, you got us on that, we better have it. Mm. Interesting point you mentioned about negative gearing a couple of years ago now, 2016, and one of the reasons Labor announced it was they thought the government were going to do something on it. And the government
had done
the work on it, and they'd started to prepare the electorate for it. And they knew that something needed to be done. We had a property price bubble in Melbourne and Sydney, so sooner or later you're going to have to do something about that. And they decide not to act simply because Labor said it. Now, I'm going to give Matthew Guy credit here, even though he's soon to be, I think, an ex-opposition leader. The thing that was most annoying, and this started in Victoria, even before he got to Canberra, the most annoying thing in Victoria the previous two elections, not this one, the previous two elections, was this stupid, childish argument over infrastructure. If one side was committed to do something, the other side was seeking a mandate to tear up the contract. You know, so Labor are doing trains, the Coalition are going to do roads. The Coalition lose an election, didn't do any work on trains, didn't get started on the roads. Dan Andrews comes in a few years ago now and tears up that contract and pays the contractor $1 billion not to do any work. Now, between Andrews and Guy, you could see it through the course of this year. Were they going to get into another, he said something must be wrong, bidding war on infrastructure and basically stop Victoria from building for another 4 years? They actually decided not to do it. So forget all the other stuff that they did and a big payback at the electorate. At a state level, and the same thing is occurring now in New South Wales. It didn't happen in the ACT, by the way. They had a referendum on whether to tear out the train track down Northbourne, no, the tram track down Northbourne Avenue. So the Liberals went into the last ACT election and they were going to literally dig the tracks that went in out of the ground. That's what they were asking people to vote for. So I think at a state level, politicians have got it sooner than they do at the federal level. At the federal level, because federal governments don't do much anymore, they don't control, they don't pull as many levers. I think they're still in that headspace of denial if another side does it. And we probably didn't mean to go to Julie Bishop just yet, but the things she said today, encouraging her side of politics to accept Labor's position on their policy...
On the
energy guarantee.
Yes.
So the thing Malcolm Turnbull loses his job over is still live policy. It's theoretically there but not going to be activated. Bill Shorten says, okay, it's my policy. By the way, I didn't give Malcolm Turnbull assistance when he needed it on the floor of the Parliament to have got it through, and he could have got it through a couple of months ago and settled the issue for both sides. He's now said it's our policy. It's impossible for the Coalition to argue against it because it was their policy. So he's trapped them. probably too smart by half, but Julie Bishop today says, back him in, do it. And I know she's sitting on the backbench and has no intention of putting her hand up for the leadership, but this is the first play in an attempt to reset the government before the next election, I would have thought.
And that was the kind of strategy that Kevin Rudd really successfully used against John Howard, just neutralising issues that were going to do nothing but cause trouble. This election next May is going to be, I mean, if it lasts that long, I guess we shouldn't assume anything, there'll be two contests, and I don't remember an election sort of like this in my adult life where you're going to have the normal two-party assault, but perhaps the more significant one within the Liberal Party. Definitely. And, I mean, how do you think that'll play out? I mean, it's a bit crystal ballish, this, but can they get to May without completely imploding?
I'm not sure because, you know, even in the last week or so, the Julie Bishop statement today, you know, you've got already this week a number of moderate people in the Liberal Party coming out and saying we've got to be more centre, we've got to govern for centre. But then on the right, you're seeing people say, including amplified by columnists, it was because the Liberal Party wasn't, you know, far right enough. Mm. Incredible kind of stretching of that broad church, you know, it's about to split, it feels like anyway. They've got to get, obviously, the next election barring crisis will be May based on the budget, you know, announcement today. But, you know, you're going to have that intra-party battle and then the battle between the two parties and then a huge amount of crossbenchers injecting themselves into the mix for the election.
Yeah, I think it is operating. It's almost a multidimensional game here now. I'll put the government's internal problems, which is the Liberal internal problem, to one side, and I'll even put the coalition to one side. In the regions, and remember, two of the last three elections have been coin tosses. 2010 hung parliament. The incumbent was able to secure minority government with the help of two independents in the bush in New South Wales, a Green in Victoria and an independent in Tasmania. So that was Gillard's minority government, which lasted longer than any other minority government in Australia's history, we now know, because some of the others in the past didn't last, and I don't think this one is going to last as long in minority status. I think, and given that 2016 was also very, very line ball, I think the incentives on the ground with the National Party in the difficulty it is, if the National Party is still flirting with the idea of bringing Barnaby back, you almost are going to unleash a wave of female independence literally in every National Party seat across the country. Some with higher profiles than others, they only need to win two or three to basically make that party, put that party into the past. So think about it, and this has been the electoral history. Everyone's been predicting the sort of decline on the National Party, but they're relatively resilient because local member tends to hold the seat. But when they lose a seat, either in a three-cornered contest to the Liberal Party or to an independent, they never get it back.
Yeah, good independent will just increase their margin
all the time. So the difficulty, this is the first bit of the story, and this is, in a funny way, I'm starting at the bottom, but this is, may well be the most significant thing for what happens after an election. And it may even manifest itself before the election. If the coalition, if the National Party survival instinct is to differentiate from the coalition may actually break up before the election. It's something that you can't rule out. Now, the argument within the Liberal Party, I've been scratching my head to think of a parallel, and the only parallel I can think of for a sitting government blowing itself up to this extent and not really caring, because I don't think they care at the moment, is Labor under Scullin in 1929. Mm. So that party split three ways, couldn't, basically folded under the pressure of the Depression, and you can't really blame them in those days. They win a pretty big majority going into 29, Wall Street crashed, and then in 1930, London was calling in all the debts and we're broke. 30% unemployment. That government split three ways. Jack Lang brought some people out to one end, so to the left. The United Australia Party forms with Joe Lyons and one of his sidekicks moving to the Conservatives, and the rump of the Labor Party is left. In fact, that rump still had confidence on the floor of the Parliament even after it split three ways for another few months before the election, and then they get smashed. That history tells you that if that happens to a government whilst it's governing, it's impossible to put that party back together after an election. And it went for about two or three elections, really until Curtin comes along towards the end of the 30s, he's able to put that thing back together again. The coalition may split before an election. The Liberal Party itself may have well and truly split by the time we go to an election, next election. It won't be just Julie Banks on the crossbench. There might be three or four of them. And meanwhile, at a party level, they're running all these pre-selection fights.
And, you know, the crossbench may also see someone like Craig Kelly, who looks like he's going to lose his pre-selection, and he's on the other side of the party, not, you know...
Yeah, and this is it, and different, completely different circumstance, but this is what happened with Scullin. It went both ways. The Senate didn't hold. The Senate in this government may be the first thing to split. The right may stay. But I think it will go in opposite directions. Just when they lose their pre-selection... but they've still got currency because they're still a serving member of parliament, they do one of two things, don't they? Mm. They take it on the chin or they go crazy. Every one of them to date has gone crazy. The other guy that didn't want to be on Q&A the other day because he no longer had a safe spot on the ticket, suddenly is no longer a Liberal. Anyway.
There's a real feeling of sort of combustion, isn't there, at the moment?
Absolutely. Mm. And the thing to remember about the Nats too is they stretch between, you know, they have the same kind of split in the party or the same factions. You know, you have progressives like Darren Chester, more at the progressive end of the National Party in Victoria, of course, up to Queensland, you know, the George Christensens of the world. So you know, they have the same internal rumblings, you know, and under Michael McCormack, who hasn't set the world on fire as a leader of the National Party. So, you know, anything could happen in there too.
And meanwhile, of course, like somebody from Disneyland, sits Bill Shorten, who, you know, Kevin Rudd's great gift to him, of all people on earth, was to have stability of leadership, that he would get this clear run up until an election. I mean, obviously, you compare that, the stability, you know, and that's what people...
Here's a couple of ways to think about it. If they'd lost one of those two seats in the by-election, if Malcolm hadn't gone for, what was it, an eight-week campaign. Mm. So those two by-elections that Labor worried about at the start, Braddon and Longman, the bright sparks on the coalition is, you know, almost cost Andrew Probyn his job, but it should never have even got to that point. Remember, they pitched the weirdest date of all, which happened to coincide with the ALP National Conference.
Yeah.
So they were playing student politics games. And ended up extending the campaign, the mini campaign, out beyond the point of logic for a sitting government if it wants to pick off an opposition member. So if they'd gone straight to a by-election, Labor wouldn't have had the time to trial through, especially Longman, this ground game of theirs, which is really one of the reasons I think the government is cracking up, is that they're intimidated by the number of people Labor can bring out an election campaign versus the absence of volunteers on the Liberal side. But I think if Turnbull had been a politician, this is sort of like saying, you know, if it didn't rain on a wet day, Turnbull was never going to be a politician. I think this is one thing we can... This is one of our big takeouts on his career in politics. But if Shorten had, if one of those seats had gone, I don't think Shorten would be leader today. I think we would have been in a different headspace. I think Dutton would have still come after Turnbull because...
Morrison.
I mean Dutton.
Oh, you mean Dutton.
Dutton would have come after Turnbull.
Just checking.
Okay. Thank you. Because remember this event last year of Alice Workman? We were thinking, oh, hang on a minute, the noises even then was for Challenge, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
So they went to the end of that year thinking Challenge. And in fact, the Barnaby thing basically...
was brewing as well.
Yeah, but it bought. Mm. It probably ended up buying another 3 or 4 months respite for Turnbull. So I think thinking this through, yes, Rudd did them a favour, but they would have found a way to get rid of him if he was toxic.
Yeah, I mean, Labor people do say that.
Yeah, they would have got rid of him if they had to. Now, I won't tell you who told me this, but on the Labor side, when the challenge came to Turnbull, a Labor person who has a very, very strong vested interest in all this, of course, you know, because he sees himself as the person to, you know, to inherit this whole thing. I'm not saying it's anyone in particular. And I asked him, what would you have done in Turnbull's shoes? And he said, mate, I would have gone straight to the Governor-General. Mm. I would have said to the Governor-General, this government is imploding and I'm going to run a campaign against my own side. This is what this was the Labor assessment. The sharpest mind, to my mind, on the Labor side, said, this is what I would have done if I was him. And we'd be having a different conversation tonight if he'd had the guts to do that. And I don't think it occurred to him, or I don't know, maybe he's, all that week he was sort of trying to be so restrained, when what he should have done was just said, this is crazy, I'm not going to let it happen. We've already had one vote. We're not having a second. I'm going to the GG.
Well, it's also what Kevin Rudd should have done in 2010 and, or you know, earlier with the climate change debacle. That there's a sort of they always assume things are going to get better with time.
Even as I say that, I'm quoting somebody, but I tend to agree with them. Even as I'm saying this, the solution to the volatility is another early election. Screwed up.
It's very volatile.
It is screwed up. Yeah.
But, I mean, you said something there about student politics, and I think that goes to the structural problem, right? Mm. So, you know, the sage advice always for people who want to get into politics is go and do something else first. Mm. But the reality is if you go and do something else first, it's much harder to get a seat.
To get in, yeah.
And, you know, Catherine Murphy wrote that fabulous essay for Mianjin on, you know, the political life is no life at all. And so you've got this shrinking of the gene pool with a whole lot of people who are just, you know, have played politics from student days and still think in that mindset a lot of the time, at the same time as, you know, people on the outside are looking in and going, the last thing I want to do is get into politics, really looking at it. Do I want to give up whatever career I have, you know, my reputation? You know, it's just, I think it's having an effect on our democracy now.
If you would like to ask a question, put your hand up and start talking when there's a microphone placed in it.
Thank you very much, panel, for an interesting discussion. I'd like to raise the issue of the preference whisperer. And we note that in Victoria it looks like 10 independents from micro-parties, that the preference whisperer is apparently going to be paid by those who participate, and Fiona Patten apparently didn't and lost out because of it, and also those who get in. It seems at this stage anyway that what was happening was legal, but it also seems that the upper house system in some states and federally, the electoral system is pretty much seriously broken. I'm wondering on your thoughts of when and how that can be fixed.
Oh, I don't know.
It's only WA and Victoria left.
Mm. Yeah, because we have had, this was one of the triggers for the double dissolution the other year, and both Labor and Liberal did put their heads together under the sort of Turnbull Shorten corporation, as it was then, just to fix the Senate. And there's every reason why you should, and that is you don't want the balance of power in the hands of someone who only gets a percentage point or less of the vote. There's clearly something, proportional representation I accept for the upper house, that is our system, but the way the thing has panned out, now we're all Victorians here, when you saw that ballot paper, there was no way you could have made an informed, I didn't know the name of half these parties anyway, and there were lots of them. But I also knew as a citizen that if I voted above the line, I had no idea where the vote was going to go anyway. So I think that this will be in Victoria the last time you'll see that. But I think I'll take your question, I'll take it in a slightly different direction. I think the idea that a preference whisperer should be charging people, I think it should be illegal. I don't understand how you can monetise democracy like this. Barry Cassidy and I had a long conversation in the lead up to the 2007 election, and we were comparing polls and the betting boards, and the betting boards had clearly misread what the swing was going to do on the ground. And he and I said, you're lucky we're good, honest journos, because we'd never put any money on this, but if you had half a brain, you'd be able to wipe these bookies out with the odds that they were setting for the seats then. So we understand this. It's sort of in our DNA not to try and make money out of something like this. By the same token, I don't think a third party offering what a consultant's fee in exchange for sneaking you into a...
I don't think you can do it. How can you do it?
There's a broader thing in this question too, Gabrielle, that where there are things like that that are just so obvious that they're wrong. Just undemocratic, they're just wrong, and it's not just with preference whispering, it's to lobbying, money. I think the last federal election, it was $60 million, the two major parties, I think. Things that are just wrong and yet they still exist. How do you change that?
Well, I think the crossbenchers are trying to change it right now with the National Integrity Commission. And AJ Brown, the professor from Griffith who helped draft that legislation, said very much this is just a start. So once the government agrees in principle, I think we'll watch them try to water down McGowan's bill, which is maximalist in its intent and scope. I interviewed AJ Brown. He just said, there is so much to be done. You just start with the in Parliament stuff and codes of conduct and things like that, and you work your way, and it's a constant journey of, trying to get into those opaque areas of lobbying, where the money goes, money trails, associated entities, all of that stuff that is all completely legal.
Mm. We will end up in the long run, not just with a corruption commission at a federal level. I've never understood this argument that we're not a corrupt country, therefore we don't need a corruption commission. That's how they argue it in Canberra anyway, as one of their arguments. But the other thing is, given the interference in nation states' election systems and the potential for real mischief in the digital age, a country like ours can only really deal with that threat of dirty money coming from any part of the world or within Australia via third-party transaction through proper public funding of election campaigns. And I wonder if you can convince the system to accept that, and then you set the rules for what the conduct of a campaign should look like, and make them turn up in town halls and all this sort of stuff and have three debates and have rules around all that stuff. I would love to see that happen. And as a trade-off for them being relieved of the burden of, doing crazy things and accepting money that has, consequences in the long run for our national sovereignty.
Mm. This is probably a question for Gabrielle, but George may also have an opinion. I find it completely mysterious that the National Party is not recognising climate change, and the constituents of the National Party, relative to the metropolitan areas, are becoming poorer. I would have thought they are more and more naturally aligning towards the left than the right. Would you please explain the enigma?
Yeah, it's an enigma I always wondered about, which is what led me to write the book. On climate change specifically, I think what happened was if we're going into the Kevin 07 election, and John Howard took a climate change policy to the election, and it's not a coincidence that that happened during a drought. So I was working for my little... one horse town newspaper at the time when my kids were little, and all the coverage for there was about climate change. So our residents were organising to see Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. It had a sort of bipartisanship around it. From the moment Abbott rolled Turnbull and made climate change an issue, the cultural stuff in the bush that happens around the two major parties, or the Coalition and the Labor Party, kicks in. And so suddenly you can't talk about climate change anymore because a coalition voter, you know, didn't accept climate change and a Labor voter did accept climate change. So everything went quiet on that front. And, you know, you can track it through actually through the National Farmers Federation where David Crombie, the president, was talking about it being the greatest threat in 2007 to farmers. He goes quiet and quotes Ian Plimer in 2010. So, you know, you're getting... The constituents are getting all these signals, so from their party, from their advocacy groups, and it was a real, I think, a real hole, you know, for the National Party and for the National Farmers Federation, which was really quite reprehensible, as farmers are kind of noticing the change. Now, I think that's shifted, and all the data that's around shows that it's starting to shift, and it's shifted in a way that before, in those very fraught years of Abbott, people would not say that they accepted climate science. Now people tend not to say that they don't accept climate science. So it's there may be some people who still don't, obviously there is, but that cultural shift has happened. And on the general economic stuff, yes, you know, the National Party seats are some of the poorest seats in Australia. And if you were to design a country party from the ground up, I would think that it would sit in the centre of the two major parties, which to me in this current political environment would be a very fertile place to sit for a political party. But they want to be ministers. They keep trotting out this argument that you have to have a seat at the cabinet table. Now, for my mind, particularly this year you've seen, and also from the agreement with Tony Windsor and Rob Oakeshott in 2010, that actually the big reforms that have happened for rural Australia have tended to be from the outside. You know, it happens almost kind of by accident more than, you know, having a seat at the table. And, you know, if you were to read the Zeitgeist, I would think that rural Australia, which is about 30% of the population, would have maximum leverage, you know, being separate to a coalition, you know, being a standalone party that sits on the crossbenches and has the balance of power every single term.
Last one, quick question.
The Wheeler Centre and Sally and all your wonderful participants during the year, it's been fantastic. Can I just ask you, please, to just touch on the fact that ScoMo came from being a bully, he was sacked, he bullied his way through pre-selection, bullied his way through the party, bullied his way all the way up. And also, that's the only image we see of him now, daily in the news press. But one thing that hasn't been mentioned has been Reefgate. Are the Liberals going to get their finance because they're bankrupt for the next election somehow through the back door from Reefgate?
Oh, George, oh. Gab.
Gab, go for it.
Reefgate. I don't know where they're going to get their finance from. Obviously, their chief financier has left the building. As to Scott Morrison's past, I mean, I think that was more, you know, what I was trying to get at in terms of the comments about the gene pool, you know, in politics. Scott Morrison ran the New South Wales Liberal Party. He was obviously at the tourist organisation. It's a pretty kind of thin life experience, it seems to me, for politics. But, you know, so many more politicians are coming from these kind of thin backgrounds. That's the only thing I would say about that.
Well, for any, you know, rusted on Liberal supporters or members in the crowd, just remember the football solution. Remember Richmond. They were the most thuggish, undisciplined, hopeless team in the competition for a long, long time. They became the most mindful, touchy-feely, gorgeous winners in
the broadest
all
of churches AFL too,
and the broadest female CEO president, and you know, We were so bad, according to George's book, that in 1901 they introduced a sobriety law, which meant you couldn't drink hard liquor at half time.
This is for the playing list.
It's a true story. So anything is possible and will probably happen. I'd like to thank all the booksellers this year, as every year, Metropolis Readings, all of them that come and do this. A very quick thank you, just because it is our last event for the year, to Director Michael Williams, to the Special Projects Coordinator Hiroki Kobayashi, who organises everybody to come for this series. He just does such a wonderful job. Thank you, Hiroki. Head of Programming, Helen Withycombe, John Boy and Jose, who do a magnificent job making sure all the Wheeler events are available for podcasts at a real broadcast quality. And while I mention that, if you're missing Fifth Estate in the next few weeks or over summer, you can go to the website. They are all available. It's been a great year this year. We've had some really interesting guests. We had Katie Tur here from CNN, who covered the entire Trump campaign. We had a young guy, Pat Kinane, who gave his only Australian interview here. He worked in Obama's White House for 6 years in the communications department. We've had Darren Hinch, Jackie Lambie, not together. We've had a really fantastic discussion about public health policy, and Tracy Spicer was here talking about Me Too. It's been a really terrific year. Les Hinton, who was Rupert Murdoch's right-hand man, came in for a chat. And, of course, a couple of weeks ago, Kerry O'Brien. So it's really good listening over summer. We will be back next year. I can't wait. It's going to be a big year. We might have to have a political wrap for the first event next year. But for now, thank you both, George and Gabriel, so much for such a, you know, insightful and entertaining and terrific end to the year. And mostly to thank you to you, the audience. But thanks you two for tonight.
Thank you.
Mm. Gabriel Chan, George Megalogenis, and host Sally Warhaft, live at the Wheeler Centre on Tuesday, November 27th, 2018. Big thanks to our legendary host, Sally Warhaft. From all of us, have a safe break and we'll see you next year. Thank you for listening.